This is the final session in which I have the opportunity to ask Rabbi Rafe Kaiserbluth to explain some aspects of Judaism. One of the things that we often get a little bit confused by is the sort of the different types within Judaism. Give us a bit of a historical overview, if you can, of where this come from.
You have this very tumultuous time around the time Christianity started going. Several different sects of Jews. The ones that most commonly known, the Pharisees, the Sadducees. You had the group that eventually became Christians. You had the Essenes who moved out. You had the Zealots. Those are the major groups.
And were these theological differences?
These were somewhat of a theological difference. The Sadducees were more of, simply put, the priestly class. And the Pharisees were probably what eventually became the rabbis. And so that was a very big theological divide. Christianity, obviously, quite a different strand in some respects. And the earlier state was actually quite similar to Judaism. Mm. And so the big first seismic shift in Judaism was this move away from the temple worship service to rabbinic Judaism.
Now, was that because the temple was destroyed?
That was out of necessity that the temple was destroyed. Now, it's necessarily accurate to say that it was just the temple was destroyed and the next day, oh, we don't have a temple, what are we going to do? There was actually evidence of synagogues as early as the first Babylonian exile in the year 586 before the Common Era. Now, they were probably not used for worship, but as assembly. But already the groundwork had been laid for a different type of Judaism.
What's the fundamental difference between a priestly and the rabbinic then?
The fundamental difference is the priest is your intermediary, your proxy. When you go and worship God, you don't do it directly. You bring your worship, your animal, and the priest will sacrifice it on your behalf. Whereas the rabbi is simply a teacher, as I am. I don't do the things for you. I empower you. You need to have that direct relationship with God. It's not up to me. And so that may seem simple and mundane today is a seismic shift in how things had been for over 1,000 years or longer. As the Jews progress, you start to have, especially of the exile, the Romans, and after the temple was destroyed in the year 70, and really gets going in the year 135 when the second and final revolt fails, that they are spread all throughout the Roman Empire and into Europe. You begin to have a major center in Spain that really coalesces probably around the year 3 or 400 of the Common Era and really gets going after the Muslim conquest where they are thriving. And in our history, it's called the Golden Age of Spain. There's an incredible outpouring of literature, of rabbinic writing. They are fully fledged members in the Muslim government.
There was no antagonism at all between
them. Not really. I mean, there was definitely seen as a second class status. Mm. They were called dhimmis. They're people of the book. So they were not like the pagans. They still worshipped God in the way that Muslims understand. They just hadn't accepted Muhammad as a prophet and the Quran. Yeah. But okay. Muslims will still read the Bible and venerate people such as Moses and Abraham and Joseph and Mary as prophets and holy people. Mm-hmm. So there is that kinship, that special relationship that they have, and they were allowed to function. And in many cases, because there was the Reconquista, the Muslims against the Christians, the Jews were able to go back and forth because they were not Christian and they were not Muslim. Yeah, so they were able to live on. So that was the beginnings of the Sephardic strand of Judaism. And it was thriving until the year 1492, where they were expelled. But not by the Muslims, because the Reconquista Church had finished by then, in 20 or so years before. And then the idea wasn't to expel the Jews. It was really to force them to convert. Yes. They gave them a 3-month notice, and many of them left. Some stayed and lived in hiding. A few converted as well. And you had two things happen there. One, many of them left to Portugal. Eventually, 4 years later, they were expelled from there as well, and then spread all over the world, to the Eastern Mediterranean, to Amsterdam, which was a Spanish province at the time. Many of them went to South America, to the Caribbean. A few found themselves in the United States, and those were the genesis of the first Jewish communities in the New World. Recife in Brazil was the first one. You had one in, I think, Curacao, and then in Rhode Island. There's a synagogue that's 400 or 500 years old. 400 years old in Europe is nothing, but in the States where I'm from, that's very old.
Okay, so that's the Sephardic, which is just the Sephardic as it was in the Iberian Peninsula.
Correct, but then spread and then spread. Yes, exactly. And today it's also lumped in many of the Jews who were in the Middle East and Yemen, so a lot of the Jews from Spain went to North Africa, but you already had Jewish communities in the Middle East, Iraq, for example, Baghdad was a very ancient Jewish community, Egypt and Yemen. Today, they're kind of lumped in all together, even though they are somewhat distinct. The other major different category here is the Ashkenazi Jews, which were those who were settled in Central and Eastern Europe. So Germany was where it first began, and they migrated further east into Poland, Russia. And there you had Jews also living in different conditions, sometimes accepted, sometimes not, sometimes forced to live in enclaves, the Pale of Settlement, for example, in Russia.
That was an enclosed area.
That was an enclosed area where they had to live. In some places in Poland, for example, very welcomed at some points in the history. But then you have this recurring theme of anti-Semitism fomented by the church. It begins not long after the establishment of Christianity. And that originally was a polemic against the Jews because they hadn't accepted Christianity. And you had the narrative of the Jews had killed Jesus, which was repudiated by the church in 1960, Vatican II, I don't remember the year now. But this was the beginnings of it and has gone simmering for many, many years. But there's huge centers of Judaism that dealt with various episodes, I suppose, in its history. The Crusades, the retaliation after the Black Plague, culminating in the Holocaust. Mm. But there's been a Jewish presence in many of these countries, quite important in its forms. Now, you then have, besides the geographic distinctions, also a theological distinctions. Now, doesn't really pertain to the Sephardi group because the Renaissance and the Enlightenment never really happened in the North Africa and the Middle East. You do have this idea, though, in Europe. And so it affects very profoundly the Jews who are living there. They're in the midst of it. And so you have now a beginnings, I suppose, a reformation in the Jewish sense. It happened in Christianity with Martin Luther. And then, of course, because there's a tremendous influence on the Jewish communities there, you start to see a fragmentation, I suppose, of the different Jewish communities.
One of the issues in the beginning of the role of Martin Luther and so on was really that people were able to read printed words for the first time. Was that also relevant to Judaism?
Not necessarily, because education was always, especially Hebrew reading, was seen as very, very important. Now, the understanding of it is different. Now, but the first real difference you begin to see is after the emancipation of Jews. They're allowed to begin to fully integrate.
About 19th century, 18th century.
18th, 19th century. Yeah. They're allowed to fully integrate and become part of European culture.
Because they were not allowed to stay in a village. They were driven out.
They were driven out. They were not. There were many professions they could not have. There were places they couldn't live, a certain level of education, and so on and so forth. Many restrictions.
You go back to England in the 14th century.
Correct.
They were used as a tax collectors because a Christian couldn't collect taxes. And, of course, the king would use them as a tax collector until he lost interest. And then he would let them be murdered.
Or cancel their debts. So you have these episodes playing out in various different countries and various different times. You have then this idea that, well, I'm allowed to live as I would like to live. So whereas the distinction before would have been either you're religious and observant or you're not. Now it's more than that. It's I want to be affiliated with my people, but I also want to belong, which is a very basic human need. I want to belong to, and I don't want to be different.
You don't want to keep wandering.
I want to feel as if I'm settled. So you begin to have the beginnings of what's called the Reform Movement, which begins in Germany. And it's an idea of, in their mind, reforming the tradition so that it is more compatible, I suppose, with European culture. So some very basic changes, which are logical and have been adopted now, a couple hundred years later, by all the movements, that the sermon, for example, is given in the vernacular. But at the time, not saying it in Hebrew or Yiddish was unthinkable, was unheard of. They introduced musical instruments, which some movements still do or not. In some of the more radical changes, they moved the service from Saturday to Sunday. That has not really caught on, and almost all movements now will do it on Saturday, Friday night or Saturday. But it was this attempt to, I suppose, in their eyes, modernize the
tradition. But also to become a citizen of the country in which they placed their roots.
They were allowed to do that. The question then was, how much do I want to maintain my tradition, my heritage, and how much do I need to sacrifice to be a part of this culture? And it's a tension.
It's a tension for every religion. You see that
absolutely
in Christianity today, if
correct.
You like.
Correct. And it's also this transmission of the tradition from generation to generation. It needed to be reinfused and made relevant again. And so you have then, as a reaction to that, radical changes, this movement that became now what we know as the Orthodox movement, that was saying, no, this is too much change, too quickly. Mm. We reject it. And more than that, we reject your authenticity. That is not what we do. And so you begin to see the rise of someone like a Samson Raphael Hirsch, who is in many ways the progenitor of this orthodoxy that no, things are as they are and have never changed and never will change.
And that's not only orthodoxy saying that we are, this is the way it should be, but you don't believe that anybody else is in the same ballpark.
Exactly. If you are doing that, you are not being authentic. Okay. And so you have this poll set up now. It began in Germany, but has spread to many different countries, the Orthodox and the Reform. And they have, in a variety of different ways, evolved and changed. And the really simply put, the Reform have, and I guess I'm not sure if it's the right term, but de-emphasize the divine origin of the Bible in that it's not that it's not divine, that it's not written by God. It's humans trying to their best to understand the will of God. Therefore, if humans have written this down, humans can change it. Whereas the Orthodox perspective is that, no, this is divinely not inspired, but written by God. And therefore, who are we as humans to change it?
In a way, similar to Muslim belief.
Now,
this is the
I want to be clear.
God.
I am grossly oversimplifying the distinctions here. But in essence, that is the theological underpinnings of both of these movements.
Yeah.
Not quite 100 years later, you begin to have the rise of the Masorti/conservative movement. The conservative movement began in the States as a reaction to the Reform, in that many of the rabbis felt, or the originators of the movement felt, they've gone too far. We have a beautiful, rich tradition of, you know, several thousand years old. We are undermining and destroying it by not emphasizing the rituals, not observing the practices that have kept us together. And so it was, in a way, a return to text-based observant lifestyle, but an emphasis on also we live in the modern world. We need to accept that as well. So whatever changes we are going to make will be rooted in our tradition, but we are willing to make those changes because we need to. And the Masorti movement, which began in Europe, began as a reaction to the Orthodox, saying that you have stagnated and are beginning to become irrelevant because you are not accepting of the fact that we live in a modern world and we need to accept that we do. And we need to look to our tradition to change these things that we can. And so for different reasons, both the conservative and the Masorti movement are in essence the one and the same, just originated from different places. And so I am a Masorti rabbi. And the idea is this tension that I live one foot in my tradition, understanding the beautiful, rich tradition and history of thousands of years, but also I am a man and a human being living in the modern world, and I can't live in a way that erases or ignores one of these two sides. And it's very difficult to be in that spot in the middle.
But isn't that quite a healthy tension? Because
it
forces you to consider your beliefs. And it forces you
on
to
a daily basis.
And your place in society.
Absolutely. It's very, very comfortable in a certain sense to believe in certainties and absolutes. But that's just not reality. Life is not black and white. It almost never is. It's that place in the gray area. And Judaism also is not black and white. If you study the Talmud, for example, which is the collection of the rabbinic writings early on, about 400 or 500 of the Common Era, very rarely does it give a straight opinion, but it goes to great pains to record the discussions of the rabbis discussing various different points of view and various different aspects. That's Judaism. Within the spectrum, there's different opinions, and that should be encouraged. That is the idea of living in tension. It's not about this is the only way and there's no discussion. That's not Jewish. That's not Judaism. And so for me, this is where I've come from in this, and I've been exposed to and I've been involved with different strands of Judaism. And this for me has made the most sense.
Mm-hmm.
And again, somewhat of an oversimplification. I don't want to, and it's not denigrating any of the other movements, but this is what works best for me.
Sure.
And this is where I've chosen to live. And just a clarification, I suppose, also is that there isn't a hierarchical structure in Judaism or in most Jewish sects. You have, which is many times amalgamated together, the ultra-Orthodox and the Orthodox. That is somewhat of a distinction that has somewhat melded together nowadays, but it started, the pious, the Haredi, was more of a mystical, spiritual type Judaism. That started around the 18th century. The originator of that movement was the Baal Shem Tov. He was a rabbi, very charismatic, but very much in tune with the emotional, spiritual experience with God. And those who opposed that were the very rigid practice, practice what is very important. And so you have the sects of the Jews who you see walking around now with the hats and the long coats. That is not really orthodoxy in the sense of an ideological sense. It's more of a spiritual, emotional, ecstatic experience with God. Now, they're melded together because now they have become, in practice, very rigid, which is ironic because originally it was more about the experience, not necessarily the letter of the law.
One of the things that I was, what you were talking earlier, I was thinking that, of course, the Ashkenazi in Europe, they settled, when they were allowed to settle 19th century, 18th century, they could actually have their own land, their own properties, their own homes for the first time. And, of course, they paid the price later because a German Jew believed he was not only a Jew, but German. Mm-hmm. And when the Holocaust came, he was told he wasn't a German.
It's been the story of our existence over many, many generations that we feel, we don't not just feel we're part of the society, we really take great pains to integrate into the society. So in our services, for example, whatever country we're in, it's not just a nice tradition or custom, it's part of our law that the rabbis taught us from years and years, generations ago, is that you pray for the well-being of the government of whatever where you're living. You serve in the government, need be into the military. And that is the essence of being a citizen and that tension. And so it's quite shocking to the psyche when you would believe that you are fully integrated and a full member of that society to be told, no, you're not. And not only that, we're going to discriminate or get out and leave, which has happened far too often. And it is jarring to the soul, but it and to our a collective Jewish soul, but it also is not unexpected sometimes, and it is in some cases a catastrophe to the Jewish community. But we always seem to respond to it. But it's not to undermine the catastrophe that happened to Judaism, the Sephardi Jews, in Spain, you know, 500 years or so ago, or to German Jewry, European Jewry, which only 70 years ago, which we're still coming to grips with, how much. We don't even know how much we lost. We don't even know, besides the number, the people, the potential for learning and discovery in both the religious and secular realms. We just don't know.
We're going to come back to a number of issues when we get the three of you together. Rabbi Rafi, thank you very much.
Absolutely a pleasure.